there are always people who get nervous, especially in an economic downturn. And, you know, our job as finance professionals is to not only tell the truth about the financial situation of the company, but provide comfort to those people to make sure that they understand where we are.
Welcome to Recession Proof, a podcast by Ramp. Join us for in-depth, thought-provoking conversations with finance leaders, executives, and investors on the current state of the market and what this means for your business through 2022 and beyond. I'm your host, Alex Song. Hi, Keith. Welcome to the podcast. It's been great to have you on the show. Keith, who currently heads up finance at Modern Treasury. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Alex. Happy to be here. So excited.
Definitely. Keith, first of all, I think congratulations are in order, right? I think earlier this week, you guys announced a partnership with Goldman Sachs, which is really cool. Obviously, you saw it all over the news and kind of the Twitter sphere and whatnot. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's an exciting partnership with Goldman Sachs. We're, you know, partnering more with them at a technical level to get customers to work with Modern Treasury and Goldman Sachs together, especially those customers that are, you know, mid-market and up, and who are moving money as part of their business. And we think it'll be, you know, a huge win for us, for Goldman, and for our customers.
That's really cool. That's really cool. Anyway, congratulations are definitely in order. It was a pretty big announcement. We definitely wanted to make sure that, you know, we flagged that. But let's back up a little bit. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself, who you are, and maybe your career path, and then maybe we can delve a little bit more into Modern Treasury.
Sure, of course. So I actually started my career out in public accounting, spent, you know, 6 years at EY, mostly doing audits of high tech and biotech companies here in Silicon Valley. And after that, the last 10 plus years or so have been working at various private companies, maybe notably Palo Alto Networks, which was, I was there for about 4 years, joined when it was private and stayed until, you know, 3 years after it was public, probably something in that range. Also spent 4 years at Segment, which later got acquired by Twilio, and a couple other smaller stints, most recently at a company called Screen, which was acquired by Datadog, and now Modern Treasury for a little over a year, almost a year and a half now.
That's very cool. That's quite the journey, and obviously a lot of, you know, household names, I would say, at least in Silicon Valley. That's awesome. How did you find the team over at Modern Treasury? How did you and Dimitri find each other?
Oh, man. So investor in Segment introduced me to Dimitri and the team. And I had told him that I was looking for a new role after the Datadog acquisition. And he said, I know you don't want to look at fintech, health tech, ed tech, these other kind of vertical SaaS companies, but you really should talk to Modern Treasury. They got something good going on there. And so I was like, okay, I'll talk to him. So I talked to Dimitri and was really excited about what I heard about the company and the team. And I felt like we had really good chemistry. So just kept the conversation going. And lo and behold, here I am.
That's really cool. And why don't you tell us a little bit about Modern Treasury? Because I think it's, you know, it's non-consumer facing, obviously. It's a little bit non-intuitive. You're kind of deep in the infrastructure. So yeah, I would love to hear a little bit more about what you guys actually do.
Yeah, right now we're a payment operations platform, and we help companies who move money as part of their business or part of their product to move money at scale, right? And a lot, that's a pretty big problem and a pretty big challenge for many companies. A lot of times it's very manual. They have a lot of infrastructure. They build their own software. They have a lot of people monitoring these payments. And we abstract that challenge away. We allow our customers to connect directly to their bank through APIs and move money through APIs, basically.
Yeah, as another finance professional, I think that's definitely a problem that deeply, deeply resonates with me. Actually, the reason why I was a little late dialing into this was actually I was literally on my phone. I was on my bank app. I was releasing two wires for Ramp. And I'm like, man, there's a little bit of like a key man risk, you know, where everything, you know, is more or less automated, but occasionally you have to be the guy, right, that goes and releases certain wires. That's super cool. So obviously you're trying to automate a lot of this at scale. You're trying to make sure companies are able to grow. Out of curiosity, what is the most challenging, what is the most amount of volume or the number of transactions that you guys have had to, you know, help someone move?
So in the hundreds of thousands a month, we have customers who are moving in the hundreds of thousands of transactions a month. and billions of dollars a month. So customers can really scale up on Modern Treasury. We have the capacity to handle that type of volume.
Very interesting. And this is currently across multiple, you know, money kind of payment rails, or is it on specific?
Multiple payment rails. So we do wire, ACH, RTP. We have some non-US payment types and even some customers who are doing check.
Got it. Very cool. And I think, you know, leading finance at a fintech company, I'm sure it is, you know, a unique challenge in of itself. Tell us a little bit about just what it was like when you first joined, what has happened since, how you've grown the team, and maybe give us a lay of the land as to kind of what your team looks like today.
Sure. Yeah, when I first joined, I was the first finance hire. Everything was either outsourced or done by Dimitri, our CEO. And we were probably only 35 people at the time that I joined. And now we're close to 190, 200, something like that, sub 200. And the team has grown quite a bit. And the finance team has also grown. So we have today two people on FP&A and two people on accounting and myself that make up the finance team.
Yeah, that's really cool. And how big is the company now overall?
Just under 200 people.
Okay, just under 200. Got it. This is quite a tremendous trajectory, right? I mean, from, I think you mentioned 30, 35, that was about a year ago, to 200. It's a pretty steep trajectory. That's great. You know, I'd be remiss if I didn't, you know, touch on this topic, which is really the kind of the core focus, right, of season two of this podcast, which is really just recession-proofing a company or recession-proofing a business. You know, in 2022, the environment is a little bit different than it was last year or 2 years ago. It was a little bit of an understatement, but to grow the company and to take it almost, you know, 8x, right, or whatever, in the last year certainly has its own challenges. But now that you're in the midst of 2022, any changes with respect to company strategy, hiring strategy, growth, or the finance function?
Yeah, so I think, you know, obviously that growth in headcount came with the growing cash burn, but it also came with more revenue growth. And it also came with, you know, our ability to maintain our product, build out new products and features, and build new products. So we accepted that trade-off. I think the thing that we're thinking about now is just making sure we're hiring carefully, right? And we are still investing, but in the right ways. And you know, closing down investments when they don't make sense anymore, and investing in new areas where we think that there's some promise. So I think we're being more cognizant now of the spend and more cognizant of the hiring now that we're in, you know, mid to late 2022 now.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there specific, and I know this differs, right, depending on the company, the industry, and the sector, are there specific metrics that you guys pay a lot of attention to, how they might, you know, differ from, you know, the metrics that you looked at last year, and how might, you know, you and the finance team offer, you know, differentiated guidance to the rest of your team?
Oh man, that's a tough question. I think for a SaaS company in our space, a lot of the metrics are very, very similar. I think what happens though for us specifically is as we grow, we're looking at more unit economics and efficiency metrics. When you're fairly small, the efficiency doesn't matter too much. You're just trying to grow the top line and you're just trying to figure out like how to get revenue to grow. And we're still a little bit in that phase, right? But as we turn the corner here and get bigger, we are starting to focus a little bit more on, you know, CAC and LTV and some of the more traditional SaaS efficiency metrics, maybe magic number, and trying to make sure that those numbers start looking good or we can start seeing repeatable success with those numbers within benchmarks.
Yeah, this is actually kind of an interesting topic. And I know it was a tough question, right? And the reason why I know is because I think you hear even at Ramp, we still grapple with, right? What should the North Star metric be? And depending on the team that you work on or your function, right? It's not always going to be the same one, right? There are going to be folks who are a little bit more concerned with top line. Folks are going to be more concerned with gross profits and contribution. And then there are folks mostly in the finance side of the house, right? You're a little bit more concerned with just the bottom line, net income, cash burn, et cetera. It's certainly a question that even we grapple with. Yeah, I'm sure folks everywhere grapple with. Do you find that, you know, it's been easy or hard to chat with non-finance folks inside Modern Treasury about the P&L and about financial metrics? Or is that, you know, a little bit easier of a conversation because these guys work at a fintech company?
No, I think it's the same everywhere, I feel. I don't know about you guys, but I feel like it's the same everywhere. There's some level of education
yes.
you need to do with the employee base so that they know what's going on in the business. So, like, for example, every single month we have, or once a month we have all hands, and I present, you know, the financial metrics, very high level, but I try to dive into a topic or two about the metrics. So last month we talked about CAC and what is CAC and how is that calculated? What is our CAC? I think the month before we talked about LTV. We've talked about, you know, things like ARR. How is ARR calculated? When do we count ARR? Things like that. We've really tried to bring the employees along and educate them through the process here so that they are educated and they know what's going on. It's pretty complicated. So
it is a pretty complicated business, right? And some of these metrics could get, you know, quite nuanced. But I think my experience totally resonates with yours as well. Every time where I've done one of these presentations about something that's happening on the financial side of the house, actually they get to be quite well received.
Yeah.
From non-finance folks. It's good. I mean, the educational process is fun, right? And it's also part of the reason why we're here, I suppose.
Yep. We get really good marks on the finance presentation that we do every single month, and employees are really happy that we do that. And I think it helps that it's just more than just spitting numbers out at them and telling them everything's great, right? They can learn and evaluate for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Would love to hear some of your thoughts about just, you know, preparing for, you know, a potential macro downturn, right? And making the company potentially more robust. What are some of the things that you guys are thinking about or maybe not thinking about, you know, as you think about navigating the rest of 2022 and 2023?
Sure. Yeah. I think actually a lot of what companies and we did is pre-downturn. So one of it was like, we're in a really fortunate position where we raised capital at the end of last 2021 and early 2022. So I take it for granted a little bit. I know that we have a pretty strong balance sheet, and I know others, you know, aren't as unfortunate of a position as we are. So the things that we're thinking about are just being a lot more careful on headcount, thinking a lot more about like where we're spending our cash, trying to look a little bit more at efficiency metrics, and trying to make sure that whatever investments we're making are going to return either on, you know, improving the product, maintaining the product, or driving revenue growth. I think there's just a lot that can be done. And right now we're trying to balance all the things that we could be doing with trying to come out of this cycle in a very strong position. And so we're trying not to have too much of a knee-jerk reaction, and we're trying to be thoughtful about the things we're putting in place as opposed to, you know, going to any extremes.
That's good. That's really good to hear. You know, I think as part of, you know, my job almost, right, I actually speak to a lot of our customers and their CFOs and heads of finance and whatnot. And I think generally speaking, that has been the attitude, right? Which is certainly sometimes there is pressure, you know, internally, externally, to extend your runway and to cut burn and whatnot. But I would say by and large, the commentary has been and is, right? If you had decent corporate strategy and you had a decent, you know, healthy execution, then you should just keep doing that, right? I mean, right. That necessarily, I mean, there shouldn't be anything broken, right? If your strategy was working 6 months ago, presumably it should still be working. And then of course, like at the margins, at the fringes, you can always cut costs. And I think that that's generally been, you know, how most people have perceived, you know, and proceeded in this environment.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it was unfortunate, but early in 2020, we had that COVID dip.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what happened was a lot of companies were slow to react at that point in time to whatever was changing in the market, maybe probably for a lot of different reasons. But I think now in 2022, we're seeing, hey, companies, you know, they've exercised their muscle in 2020, right? They know kind of what happened and how to play out some of this stuff. And so they were able to set themselves up to be successful in 2022 without, you know, a lot of big cuts or a lot of big changes.
Yeah. And just curious, I mean, are employees, whether finance or non-finance folks, are they concerned about, macro downturn or recession? And what if any, of a role do you play in terms of, I guess further education or kind of calming them down, I suppose?
Yeah, I think no matter what, employees are always concerned. There are always people out there who've been burned at a company. At Segment, I had a recruiter who sat right behind me, and she'll know who she is. And she would turn around every once in a while and be like, "Keith, do we have enough cash?" Because she was at a company that ran out of cash just prior. And so there are always people who get nervous, especially in an economic downturn. And our job as finance professionals is to not only tell the truth about the financial situation of the company, but provide comfort to those people to make sure that they understand where we are. So some of the things we do is we tell the team exactly where we are with cash balance every single month. Like we flash it in that monthly all hands meeting. And we also talk about, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but default dead versus default alive. And we tell, the employee base, like, where are we? Do we think we can get to cash flow positive based on our current growth trajectory, our current cash burn, and the remaining cash balance? And that gives people, I think, a lot of comfort. And frequently we have people coming back to us and asking, are we still default alive? Right. And but we try to run the business so that we are default alive and we won't need to make huge cuts or big changes in order to continue to survive. So I think that gives the employee base some comfort, and the fact that we're transparent, I think, helps as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, I want to ask you, I mean, you were a working professional, right, during the great financial crisis back in 08, 09, 10, right? And then the slow recovery, obviously. I mean, I would love to hear your experience then. What, if any, formative experiences did you have? One. And two, what, if any, similarities or differences were there? But I know I can think of a lot, right? What you were doing then and what you're doing now, and just the reaction and just everything. What would love to compare and contrast a little bit.
Yeah, I think, man, if I think it seems like so long ago now, 2008, 2009, and you're right, it was just such a protracted period of recession and slow growth. I think it's a holy cow. I think that experience has really made me much more conservative as a finance person. I think seeing so many people losing their jobs, so many people losing, like their 401ks and things like that, and people not being able to buy homes, people not being able to sell homes, like the housing prices just collapsing and liquidity completely drying up, something that I've never seen before, where, even if you have the cash to apply for a loan, or you have the job, you just can't get it. Like, no one will even give you a loan to buy a house, right? I think I bought my first house during that time, and it was a foreclosure, and the process of going through that was just so painful. And fortunately, it was a good deal, and it's turned out well, 10 years later. But man, during that time, like, credit was so frozen, nothing could be done. You couldn't, it was really tough. The builder went out of business, basically. And so what have I learned from that? I think really in my bones, I'm a lot more conservative because of that experience, right? And I actually remember I was here in Silicon Valley for parts of, 1999, 2000, 2001 as well. And I remember all the paper millionaires that were made with the bubble, and then how everybody lost everything in the bust. And I think both of those experiences have really shaped how conservative I am on the finance side, right? And so part of it is I look for companies that are going to be conservative a bit, right? So like one of the things when I talk to Dimitri and the team is trying to figure out, okay, are we going to be freewheeling and burning cash like crazy? And how diligent are we going to be about monitoring cash, and how prudent are we going to be about growing the company? But at the same time, like I will also probably be more prudent, and I will probably also raise the flag a lot more to the exec team or to the company or to whoever to make sure that we're trying to take the right actions and avoid a situation where we're caught in a poor economic situation and a poor, financial situation for the company at the same time. So, yeah, I would say it's had a huge impact. It's psychological for sure, if nothing else.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's interesting, like the generation of folks who, maybe graduated right into kind of the dot-com bubble and bust, right? And then there are the folks who graduated into the, 08-09. I think there's always these cohort effects, right? That I think persist for decades. And a lot of it is psychological. It has to do with risk aversion. It has to do with attitudes with respect to personal finance, right? And obviously attitudes about work as well, right? Do you want to stay a job versus are you, super trigger happy with going to a, high octane early stage startup and whatnot? And I think those cohort effects are very, very interesting to see. What about your day to day? I mean, back in 08, 09, what were you doing compared to what you're doing now?
Well, actually, 08, 09, I was probably still at EY doing audits mostly. So it was actually an interesting time. You get a really good cross section of what companies are doing and how they're responding to the environment. And as an auditor who wasn't planning to stay in Big Four forever, like you couldn't find a job. And a lot of our peers were unfortunately laid off, even high performing ones. Usually, audit firms and professional services in bad times, they'll kind of trim the fat and people who aren't performing, they'll let those people go. But the cuts were so deep, it was, people who you really respected and thought were performing well and, really could contribute to the company who were the ones who were leaving. So that was quite a shock, I think, to a lot of people. The day-to-day, it felt like things were grinding to a halt in terms of what was going on and what we were doing. And, it felt like a lot of business was going away, a lot of pricing pressure from our customers, our clients, right? It was, and we were seeing it, right, in their companies as well, right? Lots of layoffs, lots of pressure to perform. It was, man, there's no real day-to-day in auditing, to be honest, right? Every single day is a little bit different, which is interesting. I think that's what kept me interested for so long. And that's what keeps me interested in startups, quite frankly.
Definitely. You know what you mentioned is interesting? Like here's what's interesting. We're kind of in a weird confluence of events today, right? It's a very, very unique confluence of events. And here's what I mean by that. And actually, I'd love to hear if you're seeing the same thing, which is one, we're getting jammed by our vendors, right? In the sense that, everyone is faced with wage inflation, price inflation, and the labor markets to a certain extent are still very, very tight, right? And so, what our vendors are charging us, price escalators, and they're, they're re-signing and renewing contracts, and they're charging us, they're like the inflation premium, right? Oh, we have to charge you 9% more this year than last year. And I'm looking at this, I'm like, wow, that's very aggressive. At the same time that this is happening, at the same time, there's so much sort of negative sentiment, I suppose, right, around a slowdown, around less production and weakening employment and all of this stuff. And, is inflation now so high that demand is actually contracting? So it's such an interesting confluence of events where I'm looking at I'm getting sticker shock, right, from a lot of the vendors who are jamming me. And at the same time, the sentiment is also very tepid. It is definitely very different, right, than 08-09, which is the description that you just gave, which is everything was kind of taming. Have you been seeing that as well?
Oh, for sure. It's a very different situation. It feels very strange. Even on the hiring side, I remember 2008, 2009, even after that, it was very easy to hire. There were so many people out there looking for jobs. You open one rec and you get 100 applicants, and a lot of them are very or highly qualified for the role. And now you open a rec and nobody applies, right? And, even though theoretically, you would think that there are people out there who are looking for jobs. And sure, there are companies who are doing layoffs and things like that and people who are looking, but it's just not nearly to the same degree as it was back then. And, in my mind, similar to what you were saying, it's just like it's something doesn't click. Like the situation kind of doesn't match what I feel like I know about the economy and how things are performing and what the Fed is telling us and things like that. I mean, I guess they're not telling us that unemployment is high. So that's okay. Like that kind of jives, but they are telling us like inflation's high and that there's risk. And by raising rates, we could see an inflate. If we're not in a technical recession now, then, we could be, right?
Yeah. Next topic I want to do a slight deep dive on is just team building and kind of, you've been at a few different places, you've built out a few different finance teams, right? What does that process look like? Who are some of your first key hires and what does the path look like now for you, right? You mentioned you have two accounting professionals, you have two FP&A folks, you know, what's next for you as you think about starting a team, growing that team, and then scaling that team?
Sure. Yeah. I think very early on, I try to evaluate what pieces do we need, right? And so I've done this kind of 0-1 finance team building a couple times. And I try to start with, okay, I'm here now. What support or what do we need as a company or as a team? And who can I bring on to fill those roles? I also think I look a little bit at the market to see like, okay, am I going to be able to hire the people that I really think I'm going to need? Sometimes that's really tough. But after that, then I try to look for the best possible people for the company I'm at, right? I think everybody's always trying to find the best people or, you know, the A players. No one wants to hire like a C player, generally speaking. But, you know, there's only so many A players out there, and there's some who are perfect for like an early stage startup and some who are perfect for like a large public company, right? And so I try to find the A players who are good for my company, my stage. And I try to make sure that the talent density of the team very early on is very high, right? Because the first few or handful of hires you make are really going to make or break whether or not you're going to be successful as a finance team, and really help to establish sort of the brand of the finance team or the, you know, how the rest of the company views the finance team. And so it's just very important to make those first few hires very selectively. I think we're now at a point where we will bring on maybe more specific roles to the team, right? So very early on, we probably bring on more generalists and those who can like oversee broader areas of responsibility. And, you know, in the future, though, as we continue to grow, we'll probably bring on more specific roles. So like maybe a payroll person or things like that, and maybe bring on, try to figure out what skill sets we're missing as a team and try to bring those into the fold, as opposed to trying to find maybe like the best person who can oversee broad swaths of the organization. So I think that will change as we move forward here.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Hey, I mean, we added our first payroll specialist right at the 200 mark. And I think it could not happen, you know, 1 minute too soon, actually. It was a nice time to have brought on an additional person to help alleviate some of those issues. So
that's the perfect time. I think 200 people, and depending on how complicated you are, how many remote employees you have, you know, that's a good ratio.
Yeah, definitely. One topic I am super curious about and I have to ask you about, which I'm sure you have, you know, some interesting observations. Let's dial back the clock. Palo Alto Networks. Would love to hear about the process of kind of joining the company when it was still private, you know, being there, building out the team, building out the company, and then eventually taking, you know, that company public, which, you know, nowadays I think, you know, everyone knows it, but I think probably at the time, not many people knew what you guys did or who you were. Yeah, would love to hear about your experience there, you know, having spent a couple of years and then seeing through the IPO process.
Oh man, Alex, that was quite a wild ride. So, you know, I joined as, I think, an SEC reporting manager or something like that, you know, basically working on the S-1. And I was pretty scared, honestly. Like, I knew the team. I knew some of the Palo Alto Networks people from my auditing days. And I knew some of the new people who had joined from Sun Microsystems. And so it gave me a lot of comfort that I knew these people. But if I take myself back to that time, there were not companies going public at that time. I think...
And actually, sorry, give us some context. Like, when you joined, how big was the company? And then how big was the finance team at that time?
Yeah, great question. So I think we were probably in the 300 to 400 people range at that point in time. And the finance team was maybe 15 people, I want to say. But there were some contractors and some temporary resources in place. But it was relatively small team to gear up for an IPO. Mm-hmm. And the small but mighty, I would definitely say, small but mighty team. And a lot of what we had to do over the next 9 months before IPO was really build out the capabilities of the team, really sharpen the close process, really sharpen the reporting process, really look at, you know, the accuracy of the numbers and streamline a lot of things. So that way we could, you know, not only issue the S-1, but report 10-Qs and 10-Ks after when we were public. And so the whole team really had to come together to do this huge lift. I remember one of the first things we did when I joined was called a huge meeting together with all the people and said, hey, we've got to actually turn these historical financials into quarterly financials that we can you know, put in an MD&A or something like that, right? And man, that was a huge process. It involved everybody. The whole team was basically there, and I outlined kind of the steps we needed to go do to accomplish that. And to their credit, man, everybody just picked up and worked really hard and got all of that done. And that's usually one of the most difficult parts of the process, because you're running as a private company, you're doing things, some accrual basis, some cash basis. Sure, you might have some audits under your belt, but the annual numbers are the only things that are accurate, you know, at that point in time when the company's growing so fast. But to their credit, we were able to do it. And to be honest, it's a lot harder at a hardware company, which Palo Alto Networks used to be. It used to be much more, it was like almost all hardware and support and a few subscriptions at that point in time. Now it's largely software and subscriptions, but at that point in time, it was largely hardware. And that type of business environment is extremely, it's much more difficult than a pure software company.
That's an interesting comment. Why is that? Was it just investor appetite, or is it actually something intrinsic about like the financial reporting or the accounting?
It's intrinsic, right? You have inventory, you have warranty, you have spares, you have, you know, the margins you have to worry about, right? As a software company, sometimes you have less pressure on margins and you can discount. But with hardware, you have to make sure that you have good gross margins, right? You have shipping logistics that you have to worry about. And, you know, you may have like, probably getting a little bit in the weeds here, but you might have to have like a cross dock and like all kinds of different things. You have distributors that you have to hold inventory and sell on to end users. You have import-export controls that are, you know, you still have import-export on software companies, but it's not nearly to the same degree as hardware, and especially in the security space, right, where the government definitely doesn't want you selling some of these things to certain embargoed countries. The complexity is much higher with a hardware type of product. And I think, you know, even with consumer hardware or consumer wearables and things like that, the accounting, the finance, all the processes around that are much more difficult and challenging.
That's interesting. I love it. First of all, for this podcast, we love digging into the deep, deep, you know, nitty gritty of these details. So do not worry about that, first of all. But that's actually a very interesting commentary. So you would claim that even it does sound extremely complicated and non-trivial, but you know, at a place like Modern Treasury, like you just told me, right? For like a single customer, you might be processing hundreds of thousands and billions in transactions. And I think you're saying that even then, like sort of reconciling that and managing around that in some ways is actually easier than managing that for managing finance and accounting for a hardware company.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And the discipline you need as a business is much higher at a product company, right? Like you have to pay suppliers on time for your hardware, right? Or they will shut you off and then you will have nothing to sell, right? So if you have like a third party manufacturer, there's a couple of large ones that many companies typically use. And, you know, if you can't pay your bills or if you don't pay your bills on time, they will shut you off. And if they shut you off, you can't sell. And then you can't complete your cash conversion cycle. And it's a pretty big risk. And, you know, the street investors, they don't like to see you losing money on hardware. It's a pretty, people don't really like that. But with software, it's a lot harder to see. Well, it's a lot easier to make money on software and charge more premium gross margins. And it's a lot harder to see where you are losing money on an individual customer basis on your P&L.
I love it. I love it. The number of times that the words cash conversion cycle that have been said on this podcast is actually not very high, which like, this is like, I mean, I'll never get off this soapbox, which is, I think working capital management is so, so, so important. Right. And I think a lot of the times, particularly for, you know, high growth tech, you know, SaaS, you know, startups, I think it's often an area that is probably under, you know, appreciated. Whereas certainly for a hardware company, like you have to focus on your inventory, your sales cycle, right? Cash conversion and how you're managing working capital. So yeah, this is an area that I personally always kind of pound the table on. Asset liability mismatch, you know, managing that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think that the equivalent for a SaaS company is probably like CAC payback or something like that, right? Where you're trying to keep it within 12 months or something, whatever benchmark you've set for yourself. That's probably the closest analogy, but it's like, you're not on a razor thin timeline, right? It's like, okay, we need the cash back in 12 months. It's not like we need the cash back this week. It's a much different situation.
That's awesome. I didn't realize that we were going to be talking about this, but this is awesome. That's a super interesting observation. Now, so I guess back to the IPO process, coming back full circle. So you went through this process. It sounded like it was obviously a big undertaking, and obviously kudos to the team for getting that through. Another area that I'm pretty curious about is during one of these fairly extensive processes, right? You've got consultants, you've got bankers, you've got advisors. I'm sure you've got PR and comms people as well, helping you draft all of the, you know, S1 and MD&A and all of that stuff. By and large, are these guys actually helpful? I mean, you're paying them tons of money, but it sounds like, you know, your team was probably doing a lot of the work. You know, how helpful were some of these external folks?
You know, I think for us, we try to actually do a lot ourselves, probably more than most companies. And maybe part of it was because we had a pretty strong internal team. Our CMO at the time was, you know, top notch, and, you know, he was great at writing a lot of the information that we shared with the street. And, you know, this wasn't people's first rodeo at Palo Alto Networks. And so we leveraged a lot of internal resources to do a lot of the work. And we probably leveraged external resources less than most companies. I have mixed feelings. I think there is a place for outside consultants to help with things. And if you can be very defined about what you need and monitor them and keep them on track, then it can really be a huge benefit. So, for example, we use consultants to prepare us for 404, SOX 404 compliance. And, you know, that they weren't working on the S1, but they were working on a work stream that we needed to be a public company. And having them there was really helpful. And yes, it was expensive, but we, like, unfortunately, based on our timing for IPO and based on our size and everything, like, we had to be compliant basically 2 weeks after our IPO. And so having them on board and having that extra bandwidth was extremely helpful during a time when we were really, really crunched. So I think that there's a place for it. But I think there's also, you do have to be careful, right? There are a lot of people or a lot of firms out there who are looking for business and looking for companies who are trying to go public and trying to, like, sell you something. And, you know, it may not turn out as well as you'd hope. So you do need to be able to manage them, and you do need to be able to figure out, like, what are the best pieces to give these service providers? What are the best work streams or best things that you can give them to work on?
Yeah. This is fascinating. I could talk about this for hours. I could literally talk about this for hours. But maybe we can talk a little bit about your time at Segment as well. You know, I think for a lot of our listeners, probably another, you know, household name or, you know, near household name. Certainly, I think a lot of people here probably use Twilio, right? Would love to hear about your experience there. And, you know, another company that obviously exited, slightly different type of exit, and also very different business model, right? Much more traditional, just B2B SaaS. You know, what was it like there, kind of making that transition and, you know, kind of building out the team there?
Yeah, so it was actually, surprisingly, was a little bit of a culture shock to me, moving from Palo Alto Networks to Segment. And I kind of knew what I was getting into, but it was just, I couldn't remember. It was too long. I'd spent 4 years at Palo Alto Networks, maybe more. We were 3,000 plus people at that point in time when I decided to leave. And I joined like a...
Okay, so you went as actually. You went from like a you said 300 to 400 to 3,000.
Yep. So it went, we were, you know, pretty big and public. But going back to, going to Segment, it was a sub 100 person company at the time, and obviously private and earlier stage. So it was quite a culture shock. I was the only finance and accounting hire. I remember the HR team being very gracious to me and including me in their meetings as part of their team. So I wasn't just a one-man show, just kind of floating on an island by myself. And they provided a ton of support to help out as well. So yeah, it was quite a culture shock. You know, it was funny. I came from Palo Alto Networks, where we were building hardware primarily, and where we had maybe, you know, data centers and things like that, to a completely like serverless infrastructure. We had like nothing on-prem basically, other than maybe some routers to make sure the Wi-Fi was working. So it was quite an eye-opener, you know, from especially moving from like, there is this culture gap, I think, between companies that are in the South Bay or Peninsula and those that are in San Francisco. Especially this shift has happened over the last decade or so, where the companies in San Francisco are, you know, these smaller, very nimble software type startups, even a lot of fintechs in the city. And the culture is just so much different than what it is in the South Bay. And I just remember going, wow, this is crazy. I was one of the youngest people at Palo Alto Networks, and I became like one of the most experienced people at Segment. So it was a very, very interesting time. Obviously not experience with Segment, but you know, just overall career experience, definitely on the higher end there. So quite a shock, quite a shock.
Yeah, wow, that's crazy. Well, Keith, I promised that I would not keep you here all day, although I feel like we could chat about this and stuff like this all day. Maybe I'll leave you with one last question. You know, kind of reflecting on, you know, everything that you've seen, it kind of sounds like you've had a wealth of very interesting, really cool experiences. This is definitely not your first rodeo. Definitely not, right? Coming to Modern Treasury, being the first finance hire, building out the team, and, you know, hopefully seeing it through over the course of time, scaling up the team. You know, we're at the confluence of, you know, a couple of different macro headwinds and tailwinds and whatnot. Would love to hear, you know, what's the one thing that's keeping you up at night and one thing that you're really looking forward to in terms of kind of the rest of the year or going into next year?
Oh, man, what's keeping me up at night? Fortunately, we're in such a great position where we've got the cash on the balance sheet. So if I'm totally honest, there's not too much. I think for us as a business, we need to keep the go-to-market flywheel moving and growing revenue. And that is like, you know, very important. We're super focused on that. And of course, you know, as you mentioned earlier, the Goldman Sachs announcement, our partnerships with banks is extremely important. So for me, those are the two things that we are really focused on as a business. I wouldn't say either of them are keeping me up at night yet, but you know, those are the things that we keep our eye on. I'm really looking forward to seeing how some of this stuff plays out, especially in the global economy, right? I think there's some pain left to go as the Fed continues to raise rates. But it's always interesting to me to see how these things play out. You know, people earlier on were saying, oh, soft landing, soft landing. That's exactly what they were saying in 2008, 2009. I don't know if you remember, but all the news reports were like, oh, soft landing, soft landing. And it's been pretty hard. So I'm really interested to see like how this plays out. And I think, you know, we'll have a much better view in the next few months as to what the Fed's going to do next year as we close out this year. And I think that will inform sort of how things turn out here. You know, it's probably terrible to say, but this is kind of the time when the finance team really shines, right? This is the time when you're really glad you have the finance team you have in place, or you really have the experience that you need on your side. And hopefully myself and my team, we can step up to the challenge here.
Very cool. That's a really great note to leave this on. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Keith Masuda of Modern Treasury. It's been really, really great having you here. It's been awesome spending the last, you know, 45 minutes with you, chatting about your experience and kind of the macro environment. Thank you so much for the time.
No, thank you, Alex. I've had a great time.
Recession Proof is brought to you by Ramp. To find out more about Ramp and how we can help you control spend, save time, and automate busy work, visit ramp.com. And then make sure to search for Recession Proof in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, or anywhere else podcasts are found. Make sure to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. On behalf of the team here at Ramp, thanks for listening.